Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And just if you're having trouble keeping up with where the ongoing fast-moving political earthquake is at, so at if nobody has announced themselves as a challenger to Simon Harris by 1 o'clock today, so maybe we'll get a surprise from one of our panellists, he will be then the leader of Fine Gael, and he will make a speech, as you heard on the news there tonight, at a selection convention. So the front pages, a few of them at least, have that speech. So there's a question a lot of columnists asking today, well, what does he stand for? Well, this is what he stands for, apparently four key priorities, as you heard there on the news: enterprise, equality of opportunity, integrity and security. And in case you're wondering why housing and health aren't there, slightly confusingly, housing and health are included under security. So there are sub priorities of the priorities. The Sunday Times also has that speech. And there are more things here: small business, law and order, making work pay, and education. And also, it is he intends to reset, reconnect, and renew. It kind of sounds a bit like a mixture of Tony Blair and New Labour mixed with the Tories. Back to basics. Indeed, back to basics is mentioned there on the Business Post headline. The Irish Mail on Sunday has gone with a different angle on that story. They are saying that ministers told them that departing Taoiseach Leo Varadkar betrayed his cabinet ally Pascal Dunhu by failing to tell him in advance about a shock decision to stand down. The Sunday Independent is leading with "Can he fix it?" And they have a poll which we'll come to, but that poll they're saying suggests Harris leadership gives FG a small bounce. Public preferred Coveney or Dunhu. Most are underwhelmed by change at top. Big increase in voters wanting election now, as the headlines they're taking out of that poll. The Mirror is the only paper leading with the royal family today. "Thank you, we're both so touched. Princess gratitude after revealing cancer ordeal." And that is, I think, a statement that the Prince and Princess of Wales put out. The Sunday World: "Hutch Pal's killer salute. Dissident at centre of Regency trial carries coffin of IRA man Macaulay." And The Sun on Sunday, as Louis Walsh, who is out of the celebrity Big Brother house, declaring that he's going to try and be nicer. And that'll never happen, and neither should it. Now, our panel this morning: Gerard Howland is a public affairs consultant and an Irish Times contributor. Alison O'Connor is a columnist for the Sunday Times. Pete Lunn is a behaviour and economist at the ESRI. And Razam Ibrahim is an Irish journalist originally from Syria. Good morning, everybody.
Morning,
Brendan. Good morning.
Pete, what do you make of the kind of words salad of aspirations that we're getting from Simon Harris setting out the stall today?
Morning, Brendan. I'm particularly interested in his repeated use of the word security. So in the quotes that are in the papers, in the various papers as you outlined them, I think positioning himself, as often sort of fairly conservative politicians tend to do, as dealing with people's worries and insecurities and helping them feel more secure. I think the language he is using, more than the priorities he's putting out, I think is interesting from that point of view. There's definitely a lot of evidence that we live in a time of a lot of worry and a lot of instability. You know, people do feel insecure. They're worried about a bunch of issues, a lot of geopolitical turmoil. It's probably quite a smart pitch, actually.
Okay, so stability in a world gone mad, and for the
exactly.
age of anxiety,
exactly.
And all that kind of thing. Yeah, Alison, what do you think?
I completely concur with Pete on that. I mean, I could be here quite some time now if you were to list everything that is going on around the world, everything that has gone on over the last few years, and what we might be facing in the next year alone. So I think that is a smart pitch. And that when he stands up in Athlone today, that he'll talk about security, not just as a nation, but for individuals and families. And when you're using the health service, or even security when you're buying your first house. So that is quite all encapsulating. All right. And I suppose I think that it's interesting. Isn't it the headline of the Sindo that says, "Can he do it?" And I mean, that is the question that is on all our lips. He is certainly, he's one of the most energetic politicians I have ever come across. And despite the length of time that he has been in government and in cabinet, he has lost none of that. And I'm writing about this myself today in the Sunday Times, that even some of his Fine Gael colleagues would be a bit disdainful of that naked hunger, that energy. They'd nearly see him as a little bit too Fianna Fáil and sort of running with the hare and hunting with the hounds.
You use a phrase today, he'd say his prayers for you. What's
yeah,
that?
Or he'd say mass for you, that right. There's an element of that you might hear what you want to hear.
OK,
you know,
right. Yeah. Is that a West Corkism? Yeah?
Bit, maybe it is that yeah. I didn't.
I hadn't come across it. I like it.
That you've made me lose my train of thought now with that, Brendan. But so I think that he will bring enormous energy to the job. Right. But it's a difficult. I mean, he's coming into a coalition. It's if you like, he is coming into a pre-established throuple. Where he's now going to be the third leg of the stool. And I know that the Eamon Ryan and Micheál Martin, I think, might have felt a bit more comfortable if it had been Pascal Donoghue. They see Simon's hunger and that he really wants to bring things on and be different. And yet there's like at max a year left in this government. And there are rules and regulations. There's a programme for government. There is only so much that he will physically be able to do. And also the fact that this has all happened so suddenly, that there are elections coming so suddenly. As I understand it, he will be saying to cabinet members, are you going to stand in the next election? Pascal Donoghue has already said that he is. Anyway, even if he didn't, I would still have found it extraordinary for him to be moving him, given that there's so much trust in him as a minister and also in his role as head of the Eurogroup. But the thing there about the you mentioned conservatism. And the Cinda Creighton's talk, this is one of the big questions.
We'll come back to various aspects of that. We'll let people set out their stalls first. So, Ger, you're a long time, you've been an advisor, you've been involved in politics and governments down the years. What do you make of this stall he's setting out today?
Well, words mean what I contend they mean. In other words, they're pretty meaningless unless they're supported by action. He's going to get a win behind him over a few weeks. He'll be Taoiseach, I think, on the 9th of April. And within a month or two, we'll have local elections and people will have made up their mind. His opportunity to make good on any change of direction is strictly limited in terms of personnel and policy and budget. There's one budget left, and that is the main way budgets decide an action policy. Most of it is already spoken for, and that which is not spoken for, there are two other spoons in the pot.
Yeah, and Bertie Ahern was very clear here yesterday that he wouldn't want to think he's coming in changing anything or pushing a Fine Gael agenda in this coalition, that he'll need to be one of three.
Yeah, he's one of three in the last year. Most of the big decisions have been made. There's not a lot to do except tweak a few things. He can certainly emphasise priorities. He can change tone. He can change a few people. Will it make much of a difference for Fine Gael? Apparently, by the way, he's a great student of and fan of Tony Blair. What that would mean for us, I don't know, but it's interesting.
Yeah, Roseanne, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I would say he should have set what he wanted to do clearly. Housing is absolutely number one, the most important issue in Ireland. It is under security, it's subsection. It should be saying out loud that housing is our problem. This is something that I am going to achieve. Health system, he was health minister for maybe around 4 years, I'd say. Definitely, he has now more power, more authority. Is he going to solve the health system, for example? And rural Ireland, this is another big issue that Ireland
is not mentioning farmers, I noticed, are getting a good
absolutely,
mention.
Because Ireland is not only Dublin. It's everywhere, little small towns in the country that they are like they need to have more voice, more presence, more prosperity, I'd say. But to Gerald's point, we can talk forever, but it's achievement, actions. Is he going to achieve that? Does he have the courage to stand in front of the nation and acknowledge, first of all, the failures, and second, solutions for these failures and what is going to happen in this 1 year. It's only 1 year.
Yeah.
It is going to save
I think he is implicitly acknowledging some, in the things he says he's going to do, Alison, is he implicitly acknowledging some failures of his predecessor, maybe?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's kind of open season and that, Brendan.
We will listen to people.
In terms, I mean, exactly. And humility, civility, winning back trust. And I mean, it's open season that, and well known, an open secret that people feel that Leo Varadkar's eye was just not on the ball since the second time he went back in as Taoiseach, and that things were not moving. And I was speaking to someone last week who's very well placed to observe Simon Harris up through the ranks, who said he is very good. He will, if he asks the civil service and his civil servants to do something, he will check back. He will say, how is that going? What is happening now? Because it's one of the questions that are being asked about him, particularly after his time is in health. What is he like on delivery? So I found that very interesting to know that certainly you can say his current department, Further and Higher Education, is not one of the tougher ones. Going into the Department of Taoiseach, you are juggling so many balls. You mentioned April 9th there. As I understand it, that might be brought back a little. As somebody said to me this morning, that 17 days is a very long time, I was told, to have two popes. And if you would even consider that he could be going into the Fine Gael Ardèche trying to ask ministers to do things when he's not, the Taoiseach.
And is it a long time as well for speculation about reshuffles and stuff like that?
All of that. And you could be storing up a lot of trouble. And I also think that in terms of even that thing about him having those conversations with his cabinet ministers, we saw how quickly a lot of the junior ministers came out or people who'd want to be promoted to the ranks. He is going to be dealing with so many people who are going to want to be scrambling, you know, up the ladder. And for 17 days for that is a very long time.
Yeah, and so he's I can see
the other thing, I suppose, that I've heard him stress, and I think he's going to stress in the speech today, and it's interesting, is this idea of civility. And I mean, this has come up as well, even in terms of, we all know, even for any politician, but even for Leo Varadkar particularly, was given such an exceptionally hard time and on social media. And I think that this is going to be one of the hallmarks as well of his, not to attack politics or that trying to encourage that all of us would try and be a little nicer to each other, be that in person or be it online.
Okay. Gerard, you picked an aspect of the poll here in the Sunday Indo, public favoured Donoghue or Coveney for Taoiseach.
So I don't think that's getting a lot of attention, and I don't think it matters very much. I think part of the reason that they have higher favourability, not particularly high favourability, it should be said, but higher than Simon Harris, is because they've been around longer and they've better names. And I think that sort of instant, you know, what brand of catch-up do you actually recognise? I don't think it's of great significance.
Okay.
I think too much attention is being paid for it.
Okay, just to say that the text-based poll was conducted on Friday and Saturday, March 22nd and 23rd. So it's quite up to date. The sample size was 1,304 and the margin of error plus or minus 2.8. Mm. It's quite up to date, and it's coming after a few days when Simon Harris's name was everywhere. So there is that aspect to it as well. Pete, you picked that as well. I wonder, is there a little niggle there that when people were kind of feeling slightly after the referendum that the government wasn't listening to them, and that now it seems that this party has given us a Taoiseach without, you know, checking in with anyone?
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, the referendums had no impact on the polls. I mean, that's interesting. We've had a couple of polls since the referendum. They look exactly the same as the ones before. I mean, so government got a bloody nose for all the reasons that we've previously discussed, but doesn't seem to have had much impact on party politics. And in a way, you wouldn't expect it to. I mean, all of the parties were calling for a yes vote anyway. Interesting thing, though, I mean, yes, it's true that the public prefer Coveney and Donoghue on this poll, this Ireland Thinks poll. But actually, among Fine Gael voters, it's not true. So Harris is ahead 32-25, which is actually quite a big gap among Fine Gael voters, which tells you that he does appeal to people from that part of the political spectrum, which I think is interesting. But I suspect we're thinking too short-term about this. I mean, if you take over as Taoiseach, as it looks like he's going to do, with, you know, probably less than less than a year to an election, you're kind of setting out your stall for a longer game, I think. And I think there's an opportunity there to do that. And I mean, I wouldn't go anywhere near saying I've got a solution for health and housing that someone might judge me on in a year, because everyone knows those are the impossible conundrums of Irish politics for the last 20 years. And what you've got to do is signal that over a longer term period, you do have a plan and you have the competence to
deal
with it.
So he's offering a vision.
So I think offering a vision thing is exactly what you've got to do if you take over where he is now, and offering detail is a hostage to fortune, because he can't do much within a year and you can't deliver on the detail. But the final point I'd want to make is, as part of that vision, I think Alison is right about changing the tone of politics. One of the things that's interesting about Harris as a character is he has a kind of warmth and a friendliness that's much more true of a traditional politician who likes to own a room. I mean, we got used to Leo Varadkar being a kind of awkward character who's very direct and in some cases refreshingly direct, right? But he was never a room owner. He was never one of those kind of classic politicians. It's interesting that Harris mentions Blair. I mean, Blair was amazing at that. I mean, he walked into a room and suddenly everybody liked him for reasons they couldn't understand. And Harris does have that kind of warmth and friendliness. Now, whether he can translate that's another question altogether.
Identify and support younger politicians more?
Well, I promised one of your producers I would look up the research on this, and I did, Brendan. So here you go. There is a political science nerd who has looked at the data across over 50 democracies, hundreds of thousands of votes, and there is a very small effect of younger people voting for younger politicians, but it's really small. It's like less than a percentage point. So the idea he's going to bring the youth vote is sort of crazy. What matters more is whether young voters identify with a young politician.
Okay. So,
I mean, you can imagine, like, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg was one of the youngest people ever to be elected in Britain as an MP, but I don't think he brought a youth vote with him. Yeah. You know? I mean, the young people actually have to
Jackie
identify.
Jackie Healy-Raye swept up the youth vote into Kerry.
Did he?
He did.
Why?
He became a sort of...
An
iconic character. A character.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He did very well.
Yeah.
But
Alison,
what I wonder about there...
Bernie Sanders in the United States got a big...
Very good point.
Our own president, hugely popular with the young.
Correct.
Yeah.
To Pete's point, I am wondering, I mean, it's being said with derision at the moment, and I don't necessarily think it should be, that he's being sort of this whole thing of the TikTok Taoiseach. I do wonder, though, if someone is seen to identify, by a politician who's relatively young, who is seen to identify with young people and the issues that matter to them. You know, if Leo Varadkar was saying things in the Dáil like, you know, well, loads of people are emigrating by choice, for instance, or, you know, making it seem that he was a bit more privileged and less understood what people were going through, even during the referendums when he spoke about care and talked about it being a family responsibility, and that's fine if you're the family that has the resources. I think Simon Harris will be better at seeming more empathetic and understanding people. Now, I know that will only go so far, but I think that that natural empathy that he has, he's exceptionally personable. He is not going to have the time now, or at least I hope he won't, to keep up his social media activity. Those are all the things that are going to change for him now. But it is, I think, for a longer term, he is looking at a sort of he is trying to make a change of tone. But one of the things we are missing, I've noticed today, is where does he stand economically? You know, the people who get up earlier in the morning, Leo Varadkar looking for the 30%
enterprise rewarding work.
It's vague enough, isn't it? That's vague enough. But again, how much can you do in the last year of a coalition? But that is a part of Simon Harris that is more unknown to us.
Okay, Roseanne, you want to come
in? Yeah, I mean,
there.
I would agree with Alison in terms of communication, effective communication. He does have that trait. To communicate with younger generation and maybe with the grassroots of Fine Gael, because they've found for a really long time there is a disconnect with the party. So he could be speaking to this grassroots younger generation.
Roseanne, you're kind of probably the most familiar with the world of social media and the online world and all that. Is it hugely important, do you think, for a new generation of voters now and everything, that they have to be as adept, politicians have to be as adept as Simon Harris clearly is at communicating that way?
Absolutely. I can tell you, younger generation, they don't open TV or read the newspapers like before. The first source of information and the news they want to get, they go to TikTok, Instagram and other platforms. So his presence there is important. He has actually significant followers on TikTok, and he has like engaging messages, And he is trying. Maybe he is trying too hard when it comes to...
Okay.
Do they smell that straight away as well, the young crowd, if somebody's trying just slightly too hard?
Exactly, yeah. Maybe okay. too hard. He should be effortless in a way to have a really good connection with the grassroots. But honestly, eventually, and after all, these are important, but would they bring a real change? I know, Pat, your idea is like it's impossible. Definitely, it is impossible in 1 year. But at least to see somebody, a leadership, standing and saying, it's hard, we know it is hard, but these are the steps. These are the solution that we are going to start. It's because it's not for political party, it's for the whole nation, for Ireland.
It's vision, not results.
Yeah. To start with vision and we will find results.
So apropos of that then, is there any chance, Pete, talking about a long-term project here, but I think there's been talk about, you know, him going into opposition, rebuilding the party. Rosanna is talking about the need for specifics and everything. There's no chance he decides to cut and run and go to the country, even with the possibility of going into opposition, is there?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things there. First of all, Micheál Martin and Eamon Ryan will put it to him that, of course, they are supporting his nomination for Taoiseach, and he will wish to confirm to them that the programme for government is a 5-year programme. He will agree to that. But just because it's agreed it is a 5-year programme does not mean it will go all of 5 years, that there will not still be an election in the autumn, but that would be based on the three leaders agreeing come the time. It is always his prerogative to cut and run any hour of any day he wishes. It'd be very brave of him to do so, but there are circumstances in which it might appeal. And secondly, he's taking over today in circumstances where Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are at least hugely reduced traditions, if not actually dying traditions. And he has a real challenge to not just reinvigorate Fine Gael, but to say why it exists and what it stands for. And I'm very unclear as to what Fine Gael stands for. And there will have to be some scoping out of that to the satisfaction of the people, up to 25, 26, 27% on a very good day, who might be potential Fine Gael voters. Because Fine Gael, as an
entity... They're fighting Fianna Fáil for those people.
And they're fighting in the centre for those votes, because Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are overlapping in terms of the votes they seek. Fianna Fáil has permanently lost its once large working class base. And that's where they're at.
Alison, you wanted to talk about Lucinda Creighton's piece. You picked a few opinion pieces, but Lucinda Creighton is to what Gerard is saying there. She's saying what Simon needs to do.
Yeah. Just before I get into that briefly, one of the other things I think that our Taoiseach in waiting is hoping that maybe there will be some people who have said they were going to step down that might change their mind. I know Brendan Griffin has been mentioned a lot, but maybe even possibly John Paul Phelan. So that's kind of will be interesting, watch and wait, considering at the moment it is a third of their Dáil representation. It really is, when you consider it's 33 TDs, I think.
And there are at least two more names, aren't there, that have
Exactly. This kind of gets to the heart of a lot of what's been said over the weekend, post the referendums. Where does he stand? Now, you could say that it's very obvious that, like, he was such a leading light in the abortion referendum and had huge respect of those on the yes side, Simon Harris, and marriage equality. There's a wing who believe that Fine Gael needs to go back more to its socially conservative roots. And Lucinda, and I suppose no surprise, a founding member of Renew, she's saying the challenge for Simon Harris, and this is a good point, is the timing of Leo's departure. But she's saying that he needs to distinguish himself from Leo. And she talks about he can burnish his credentials by reprioritising actual crime rather than imagined crime. Now, that's obviously a dig at people and Helen McEntee in terms of hate crime. Another thing that came out after the referendum, which I think was quite unfair, having a dig at NGOs, but she's saying here he should similarly get a handle on the funding and influence of NGOs, which are unwieldy and strangling the state sector. So that's the sort of pressure that he is going to come under in terms of a certain wing of the party.
Of it back to basics.
Yeah. But don't know how he's necessarily going to square that circle in terms of what he has shown us of himself thus far. Okay. He was originally anti-abortion when he started out, and then changed, and is on record saying that he's glad he changed. He's owned all of that. So it isn't that he hasn't changed his mind as he's gone up, but I guess at this stage, it's kind of late to be trying to cast yourself in new colours.
Yeah, changing your mind as life goes on is an eminent sign of sanity, I think. Pete, on any other week, if all this hadn't happened in the meantime, we would be talking about Leo Varadkar going off the political stage. And as well as that, you alluded earlier that we've kind of forgotten now, I think, maybe that sense that the air went out of him. When he came along, he was a politician that we'd never really kind of seen the like of before. He was different, wasn't he?
Absolutely. He's highly unusual as a politician, primarily because, well, my view anyway, is primarily because he answers questions. And always had, so, I mean, I generally dread listening to politicians being interviewed on the radio. I've been doing it for 20, 30 years, and you get so caught up in the deflection tactics and watching the way they're avoiding things. You know, it's a dance. It's like shadow boxing. It's really unfulfilling at times. And one of the things that was so refreshing about Leo was that journalists would ask him a question. As a politician, he would actually answer it. And sometimes they'd find that quite disarming. Now, he didn't always answer it in the way you wanted to hear, but he would actually answer it, which I think is one of the reasons why when he first appeared, everybody thought he was leadership material, because it's a real trick. It's a really difficult thing to do, and there aren't many of them.
OK, there's manoeuvres going on in the meantime, Gerard. The Mail on Sunday, John Drennan is talking about energised MacDool and Ivan Yates join 700 at Verona's rally.
This is a great piece. I think knowing that hotel as I do, I think the 700 might be slightly overstating it, but it was a very big, very good, very energetic meeting. I understand Ivan Yates as chair was there in a professional capacity, not as a political volunteer, and Michael MacDool was the star attraction.
And Michael MacDool made a speech. So this was Verona Murphy was kind of launching a slate of local
election candidates in Wexford, in a constituency that's truncated by the creation of the North Wexford South Wicklow constituency, and where the sitting TD, Fine Gael TD Paul Keogh, is announced his retirement as a relatively young man. And Verona Murphy was a Fine Gael candidate in the by-election. She was chucked off the ticket when she had certain views to say about migration, and she is now sitting in firm control and possession of the good portion of the Fine Gael vote in County Wexford.
And is your understanding, was Michael MacDool endorsing this, aligning himself with this, or was he kind of a guest speaker?
He was certainly a guest speaker. He was certainly contiguous with, as distinct from aligned with. Okay. If I could put it that way, yes.
I'd actually think but that just purely say, by... Yeah.
But just to say, what's happening here in Wexford, and I think this Wexford situation, it's a once-off. I will be slow to draw national parallels with it. But what Verona Murphy is doing in Wexford is very successfully doing to Fine Gael what the PDs did to them previously. And I would be surprised if new leader Harris does not approach her with a view to her rejoining Fine Gael.
Okay, and when you say doing what the PDs did, is that taking the right of centre space?
Well, the late Brian Lenehan Sr. described the PDs as Fianna Fáil personnel, Fianna Fáil personnel, Fine Gael votes and Labour seats. Now, two of those three things no longer apply, but in sucking away Fine Gael votes en masse in Wexford, it leaves us doubtful that Fine Gael could get a seat. And if Fine Gael wants a seat the next election, their best bet is Verona, and she has a very strong hand of cards.
Alison?
Yeah, I would disagree slightly in that I think by Michael MacDool being there, it speaks alignment to me, although I know he's playing his cards close to his chest. It does make me smile a bit to talk about this, saying that at that meeting he extolled the virtues of Verona taking on the establishment. This is the senior counsel from Ranelagh. You know, he's quite the chameleon in terms of, and has been, and I mean, and I acknowledge his extraordinary role in the referendums. And they say that he noted there is a mood for change that reminded him of the PDs in 1985. So I first heard about this meeting on Ivan Yates and Matt Cooper's podcast. I was listening to it on Friday and it struck, I thought, that is very interesting. Now, Gerard has said that, I don't know that hotel, that it can't hold that many people, but even if there were slightly...
It was a big meeting.
Yeah, exactly. It was a big meeting. And that certainly I would agree that approaching Verona would be. She seems to have a bit of momentum going. Also, you'd say about the timing of the election, that for things like this going on around the country, even the new party being founded by Michael Collins and that Michael Fitzmaurice is in, they will all want a bit of time to get themselves together. But interestingly, in the business post poll, as I understand it, will I get this right, the independents are up 3, whereas in the Sunday independent poll, I think they're down 2 or 3.
Yeah, they're actually exact opposite. Yeah. So the business post poll, they are up from 14 to 17, and the opposite in the Indo poll. Do I have to read them all out now? No, okay.
Can I come in on the numbers, Brendan?
Yeah, quickly, yeah.
No, just the numbers are fascinating. So if you look at poll of polls, because all these polls have these big margin of errors, if you look at the poll of polls, it's becoming absolutely copper fastened that over the last 6 to 8 months, Sinn Féin have lost a lot of votes. They've gone from low 30s to mid 30s, right down into the mid 20s. And what's so interesting is all of that is going to the independents and to the Social Democrats. Mm. None of it's going back to the traditional parties.
Maybe a bit of AIM too as well?
A tiny bit, yeah. But that's really interesting because the standard thing in electoral cycles is that opposition parties go up in the middle and then it swings back towards the government. And you can see the opposition party going down, but it's not swinging back towards the government.
No,
it's
this goes back to further. Identity, yeah. to attraction. And I don't think a new word salad today of itself will fix that.
Okay, but on the other hand, it speaks to a very fundamental thing that I think we all kind of had to come to terms with. Maybe during the pandemic, things are never going back to the way they were, are they, Pete? That was a big lesson, wasn't it? Things are never, they're never going back.
Some things are fundamentally shifting.
If you can offer security.
Well, it may be, but some things are fundamentally shifting. The patterns that we've had for years in multiple walks of life and politics as well are not occurring the way that they used to occur. And it's going to take a real job of leadership, actually, to identify what those patterns are accurately and then appeal to people in the current climate. Because I think people are very fractured, they're quite worried, and there's much more splintering in politics, not just in this country, but other countries, and certainly has happened in my lifetime before.
Okay. I have to take a break. One texter says, you're being hard on Leo. In my opinion, he was intelligent, a very good communicator, a great ambassador for Ireland. And an emailer says, are you mad on the Leo legacy? The country's in an awful state with cost of living having gone through the roof, rents, electricity and poverty. What's next? Food banks. Okay, Gerard Howland, Alison O'Connor, Pete Lunn and Razam Ibrahim staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back, Gerard Howland, Alison O'Connor, Pete Lunn and Razam Ibrahim still with us. And look, whether you like it or not, Kate Middleton, Princess of Wales, is an enormous story. And I think there has been a cultural moment around it as well in the last month or so. Razan, you picked Eilish O'Hanlon's piece today, Not Even an Emotional Cancer Disclosure Can Halt Cruel Conspiracies.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, my heart goes out for her. What she has been through is really difficult times, and she had to explain herself while she has diagnosed by cancer. It's act of courage, I have to say. But with the very early stages, like when she was disappearing from the public since January, speculation started to rise. In January 17, a press release that she had a surgery. After that, there was a huge spike in false stories, conspiracy theory, imaginary, scenarios of why she is not there, why she's not appearing. Is it really because of the surgery or there is something else going on? I think what happened that image she posted on her account on Mother's Day, and then the editing and inconsistency in the image itself, and how some global international photo agencies, they killed the photo. Mm-hmm. That I can't tell you, the social media platforms from across all of them, unbelievable conspiracy theory against her. That would range the first, like one of the biggest ones we were seeing, that she is definitely...
Well, let's not, let's not dignify them. But this misinformation is kind of one of your areas. And so was there anything in particular about the way it all spread and kicked off? It seemed like there were people who were new to conspiracy theories, and that it got into different demographics and in different areas, yeah?
Yeah, and you know, like the unfortunate thing is that these conspiracy theories, misinformation, were spread by verified account on social media. When you have your account verified, algorithm will pick it up more and more. The more engagement you get, the more exposure of your content will be on social media. So that is one of the biggest causes. And then we saw...
So that it was not bot accounts and stuff like that. This was in the legitimate, if there is such a thing, social media.
Yeah, exactly. Not only pot. It's just like real accounts. And some of them, maybe we don't know the identity, you know, still we don't know if this is real person or not. But this story as well, I have to say, would bring a lot of engagement to these accounts. So they take the opportunity to spread wherever they wanted, because the more they like engage with the story, the more likes they get, the more maybe probably money as well, etc. So that was a huge like part of why this happened. But in traditional media also played a role. And even celebrities, you know, at some stage where is Kate using this hashtag? And, you know, but
so
because...
So the social media is not rewarding the truth as such. It's purely rewarding engagement. So the truth is irrelevant, really. In fact, the truth is probably hinders engagement at times. The lies are
definitely
more exciting.
It amplifies that. But I have to say, because of the lack of information, the vacuum of information around that time, that raised speculations more and more in the social media. And even
Do you think they should have come out more clearly initially and just told that times have changed, yeah?
I think when they released a statement on King Charles' diagnosis, there were more details, whereas Kate was less detailed on her situation, and that raised speculations more and more. Even when she posted the video on her account 2 days ago, even though, you know, still conspiracy theory would, you know, amplifying that this is AI generated, for example, etc. So, unfortunately, the story, first of all, it is important just to leave her alone at this stage. She is struggling and she needs time for her family and her privacy. But unfortunately, the other side of the story, that people will still talk, will still use this opportunity for more engagement and for more, you know, like revenue, etc.
Okay, so it's kind of an out of control thing. Alison, there's a lot of mea culpas in the papers today. You picked Sarah Vine has one in the Mail on Sunday. We all okayed a big apology, and I include myself.
Yeah, quite a self-justificatory piece, I think, and as so it should be given some of what Sarah Vine has written. She says, it's quite a political apology, I thought, the paragraph. Still, the fact remains that the furore it caused must have been very distressing to Kate in her current condition, and for that I am sorry.
Okay, so she's sorry if anyone got hurt.
I have to say, when the alert came in on my phone on Friday afternoon, I immediately felt such personal shame, because I hadn't engaged with any of it. I hadn't tweeted anything. But I guess Twitter has become such an awful place that it was lively and engaged, and there was a lot of humour, and that's what attracted me when I looked at the stuff that some people were being very funny. And the thing I felt so ashamed of was the fact that while I was having a bit of a laugh, this is what this woman and her family were dealing with. And I just think that, okay, the royals have a bit of a pact with the devil. And as Roseanne said, there was an information vacuum. But I can completely understand, and having personal experience within the family and friends, of when you get a diagnosis like that, especially when there are children involved. And children that are old enough, as theirs are, certainly the eldest, to understand things and things being said on the playground and that. But I hope that, and maybe this is naive of me, I hope it might be a bit of a turning point. Not necessarily
for
the people.
Is it for you, Alison?
Yeah, it is, I think. Because for the people who've gone over to the other side, I don't think they can be brought back. As Roseanne said, there are still people who... But I think for
people
who...
Are you thinking that you had dehumanised her a bit in it or forgotten she was a person yet?
Absolutely. But even maybe to... That maybe it's not enough, as I kind of said, was comforting myself, sort of saying, well, I haven't engaged with any of this. Yeah. But maybe it takes more than that. Maybe it takes more than people to actually say, you know, this is rubbish, this is nonsense, rather than just being passive about it. Because there are still, this will have gone towards this whole thing of where there are people who want the trust and faith in institutions to suffer. There are a whole load of people now as a result of this that will have fed into their conspiracy theories and trust in institutions and all of that. It will be further diminished. So I guess if we're to allow, and that's a really very dangerous thing, and we've talked a bit earlier about where everything is at in the world and everything, I think more of us need to try and, you know, take a bit of a more active role in trying to combat that.
Pete, this was behaviour writ large. It's your area. I saw there was a headline in The Atlantic last week, QAnon for wine moms is how they were describing it, and that this notion that it was a gateway conspiracy theory for a lot of people.
Yeah, I want to take a pace backwards momentarily. This is a moment, living in Ireland, where we should congratulate ourselves on our constitutional arrangements. Having a largely ceremonial elected head of state who has a constitutional backstop role is a superior model. And looking across to the other island, we can see what a superior model it is.
Okay.
Now, we have to not run away with ourselves completely here, right? Because you can go back hundreds of years and people were spreading lies about the health and sexual peccadilloes of royalty, right? Whether it was in pamphlets, whether in latter years it was in tabloid newspapers, wherever it was. Now, of course, what's happened is that social media has accelerated that. The human brain has a habit of latching on to narrative and finding narrative to be hugely meaningful, even when it's completely unrelated to your life, which is the success of soap operas and many other forms of storytelling. We get much pleasure out of them, but getting them interfering with our constitutional arrangements is a real mistake, which is why it's a bad model. But what I would love to do actually is quote Matthew Saeed from today, because in the Sunday Times, he describes this as kind of football hooliganism of the digital age, which I quite liked. But the quote he has here, which if you'll forgive me, I want to read. He says, "It's time that journalists started reporting what's going on in social media and online faithfully and more accurately." So he has a go at his own profession. And he says, this is what he dreams of, that what we should report it as is, "Fewer than half of the UK population are on TikTok or Twitter, and only a small proportion create any content at all. But of those who do, a tiny group of idiots and bots have invented lurid claims that have been amplified by fools and fanned by algorithms designed to make billionaire owners of those platforms more money, and that leave our society stupider and crueler." I just thought it was great.
I suppose, in fairness to mainstream media, it's chasing it for clicks. Roseanne, briefly, and I have to go to a break then.
Very briefly, that, after all, the royal family is they are public.
Yeah.
And they will be exposed to a lot of misinformation or like conspiracy theory. The long-standing approach for them is never complain, never explain. But with the social media era, this should change.
Yeah. Okay. We'll take a break. Gerard Howland, Alison O'Connor, Pete Lunn and Razam Ibrahim staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel's still with us. Gerard Howland, Alison O'Connor, Pete Lunn and Razam Ibrahim. Roseanne, you picked a few pieces on Russia. Which would you want to pick one of them and tell us about?
Absolutely horrific attack on civilians in Moscow. This attack claimed around 143 people, hundreds injured. It's one of the turning points. In the politics and the war in that in the area.
Yeah.
So
why?
Now, the U.S. embassy in Moscow, they issued on March 7 a warning that people living in Moscow, they should be aware that extremist could carry an attack. But then we see this attack happened in the last 2 days. ISIS claimed responsibility of the attack. They published a video from Amaq News Agency, which is ISIS media arm.
Okay.
And they also published some photos before the attack itself. And the US also claimed that ISIS is responsible for the attack. Now, on the other side, Russia and Putin, they are trying to defer this responsibility to Ukraine itself. They are saying that this is not ISIS done or ISIS work. It is affiliated with Ukraine. And they said that 11 people were arrested, involved in this attack, were trying to cross the borders to Ukraine. So in a way, that they are trying to use this attack to intensify war and to carry more and more operations on the Ukrainian side. And just in terms of using social media and AI, Russian NTV broadcasted a video falsely claiming that Ukraine top security official said that Ukraine is behind the attack. The video is completely false. It's AI-generated audio, not related at all, but still they are like publish it on.
So this is a state actor using
AI-generated false video to claim that Ukraine is involved in somehow with this attack. And as I said, that's a turning point. We might see intensified operations and war more than what we are seeing right now.
Ger, do you want to come in there?
It's another example of the continuing disintegration of an empire that's been going on for 20 years. The former Soviet Union had, at least in theory, a narrative of being a multi-state entity in which, in theory, the nations were respected and in which, because of communist ideology, all women and men were equal. The disintegration of that, the end of that overarching narrative, the intensification of the Russian alone identity of this political entity, it's in its internal weaknesses and authoritarianism and corruption means that it's less able in practice or even in theory to speak of, let alone control, an inclusive narrative for all its people, including Muslim parts and others. And this is another example of that disintegration, of which the attack on Ukraine was a response that was intended to push all that back, to reboot Putin's power, but of course which has backfired.
Yeah, and of course, Pete, like not making any comparisons with Simon Harris, but security is something that Putin does stand on, doesn't he? Like that he offers security, and this is now a bloody nose to that, isn't it?
Yeah, he's got a real problem. There's a lovely article, actually, at least I think so. It's really forensic, in the Sunday Times today, by a professor from London who's been writing about Russia for years, called Mark Galliotti. He's pointing out Russia has 14 million Muslims. That means that it has the largest Muslim minority in Europe. And that group are growing partly because of the war economy, that you need labor coming from Central Asia in order to do jobs that Russians won't necessarily themselves do, but also increasingly need filling because they have an economy that's trying to fund the war in Ukraine. And so many young men are also heading out to that war, obviously. So this is a huge headache for Putin because, you know, he's now facing that obvious issue of, you know, he's relying hugely on this community within which there's a very, very small number of extremists who everyone who's been dealing with this issue for years in other countries knows is incredibly hard to deal with as a social issue and as a security issue. But as you rightly say, security is what he stands on. So he's going to have to find a way to deal with it.
And he can't do a Trump-style clampdown on the borders because they need...
He's got land borders and they also need the immigration to keep that war economy going. So interestingly, another point Galliotti made just briefly is that apparently Putin said to the television stations that he was going to come on and respond to the attack three times, and they cleared the schedules to put him on, and he didn't appear and he didn't appear and he didn't appear. And then eventually when he did appear, he was pretty ponderous and didn't say a huge amount. So it's a real headache for him.
Okay. I must say, I recommend that Sunday Times piece as well. It gives a really good context. What I would wonder about now, and it's that unknowable thing within Russia and with Russian people, how many people believe it was ISIS, or how many, as a result of what Razan was saying about the this AI video, which I find intriguing, particularly as a journalist, and even in terms of our upcoming elections and elections everywhere else around the world, in terms of Putin's credibility, which at times seems unassailable when you hear it. But is he going to become now like the boy with his finger in the dike? How many frontiers can he? You know, it's Ukraine. It's ISIS. I had no idea that they had that sort of a Muslim population in Russia. You know, so it's there's only so much one man can do.
That they are viewed as a great Satan due to their operations in your country, Razan, in Syria, and for other reasons. And that they are like America, a great Satan in that.
ISIS killed Muslims, more Muslims than any other group in the world.
Okay, listen, there's something I want to get to before we finish up, because a few of you have picked pieces on this, and it's something we were touching on yesterday as well. So will we start with you, Gerard Howland, and tell us about this new phone hack you've come up with?
And I've applied it to myself since about 7 o'clock this morning. So Cormac Lucy, in his piece in the Sunday Times, has a postscript, and it's based on a woman called Mary Wakefield. And she writes for The Spectator, and it turns out in real life she is the spouse of one Dominic Cummins. And she's been concerned about addiction to iPhones, spending too much time scrolling, looking, and these colours attracting our dopamines and addicting us and so forth. And her recommendation is you go into your iPhone, you go into settings, then you go into accessibility, then you go into display and text size, and that brings you to colour filters. And what you do with the colour filters is you turn them off. Everything remains the same, except everything is black and white. Your dopamines are no longer being as vigorously attracted. Yeah. And all I can say is, if she has managed to control Dominic Cummins' dopamines, the woman deserves the Nobel Prize.
Is your dopamine feeling a bit less vigorous?
I hope so. Well, of course, I get a bit excited when I come on here, obviously. But otherwise...
Well, you can go back to black and white when you're out of this technicolour world in here. Razan, you picked Julia Maloney has a piece in the Sunday Indo, Children Left to Their Own Devices.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we should be more and more aware of how younger generation, and especially children, you know, like I'm saying age 5, 6, 7, are consuming social media. And understanding that once our child opens the mobile phone, social media generates money from them. They want children to be on the social media as long as possible because of ads. Targeted ads again, like towards the people, and generate money and revenue, etc. In a way, like it is growing, and the situation, there is no much awareness of raising that awareness on the children that they should go to street, they should go to play, they should have like physical interaction with their colleagues, with their friends, etc., and Alison, manage the time on
that. I just want to get the others in before we finish up. Alison, I think Julia Maloney is kind of basing on Jonathan Haidt, who's been writing about this for a while now. There's a new urgency in his recent writings and his new book, where he's saying we need a cultural U-turn on this, and it's urgent.
I'd love if he'd do a home visit, to be frank. Yeah. I mean, I'm speaking as a surrendered parent. It's something that would worry you so much as a parent. It's also something that, as a parent, one is entirely and utterly hypocritical, and spends one time shoving the phone under my thigh as I see the door of the kitchen opening, or under a tea towel, or under the quilt, worse again, under the duvet. And you really do feel powerless, because then it's the sort of but I need it for my homework. Or just another, you know, and then you forget. And I mean, I would love to be one of those parents that has some sort of an app that limits time and limits. It is possibly one of the most difficult things about modern parenting. And you say that knowing that all of these warnings from people like Jonathan are absolutely correct. And what are we going to, like, if I suggested, as Gerard has said, the going black and white, even that, I would suspect I wouldn't have much success.
Yeah. Good talk, Mom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You go back out there to RT and talk to your friends.
The other old people. Pete, give us a final word on that.
Well, we've heard it here, and it's written mostly in the papers this weekend as a social and cultural issue. But I actually think, to a very large extent, it's an economic one. And because we don't think of it as an economic one enough, we're actually failing to tackle it. So what I mean by that, and it goes back to the quote that I read from Matthew Saeed earlier about the billionaires who are making money out of this. I mean, essentially, this is a market. And we're being sold things by people who are making huge amounts of money by designing things that are addictive and that increasingly research shows are doing us no good, are doing our well-being and mental health no good, and are not doing any good for our children either. Now, whenever that is true, whenever there are private companies that are making money and causing bad externalities, we get in there and we regulate them, and we do it really hard, and that's what we need to do. And eventually, someday, maybe that's a nettle we're going to grasp. I really hope we do.
Okay. Thank you very much to my panel this morning. Gerard Howland, public affairs consultant and Irish Times contributor. Alison O'Connor, columnist for the Sunday Times. Pete Lund, behavioural economist at the ESRI. And Razam Ibrahim, Irish journalist originally from Syria. And it's just coming up to 12 noon now, and we'll go to the newsroom and Eilis Sheehy.